There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, Stephen, and there you have it. There you go.
Hello, this is Desiree for F1Weekly.com. I'm your in-depth correspondent.
Let's go with the qualifying, Steve.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Nasser Hamid, my co-host. This is podcast number 637, September 23rd. 2013, and of course, this is a standalone special interview podcast, and I don't need to say much more that Peter Windsor has now spoken. Nasser?
Yes, sir. First of all, my thanks to Peter Windsor and also our mutual friend and fellow listener, Mr. Phil Pegler, who made this meeting possible. It was great honor, privilege, and fascinating stories from Peter Windsor. Obviously, one of the great motor racing journalists of our time. I've enjoyed his work for many, many years. Has been team manager at Ferrari, and Williams was team manager to Carlos Reutemann, whom we interviewed a few years ago. So it was a very fascinating conversation. I thank him very much for his time. And hopefully we can chat more about motor racing, a sport we all love so much, down the road.
Okay, folks, I'm here with Peter Windsor, one of the great F1 journalists, a gentleman whose work I've enjoyed for many, many years. Peter, great to have you. Welcome to F1 Weekly. How are you today?
I'm very well, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on board.
I must say I have enjoyed your work for a long time. Before we get to Q&A, please give your thoughts on the great season we are having this year.
Well, yeah, we are having a great season. I think most seasons are great. I love Formula One, and actually, I find it quite difficult in my mind to say this season is better than that season. And I think it depends, of course, on the individual thing, what you enjoy about our sport, and you know, maybe how many overtaking maneuvers there are, how many different winners there are. In my case, enjoyment is really seeing good drivers in good cars doing what they do well, and that's what I love. And it's been interesting watching Lewis Hamilton dealing with a car that he hasn't been particularly comfortable with, and watching how he's adapted and grown. Likewise with Nico, and I love watching Kimi drive as well, so that's been a lot of fun.
Do you love his radio communication?
I don't listen to it that much, to be honest. I usually have the volume turned down. I listen to the I'm a bit isolated in what I do, but I tend to love watching the onboard just with the engine note and focusing on that and listening to the throttle, the way they're using the throttle and when they're coming out of the power. You don't get any of the graphics, you don't get any of the shouting and screaming, and you get a real feel for what it's like being on board the car. So we're lucky to be in a position to see that and to choose with whom we can be on board during the race, and that's how I watch most of the Grand Prix.
Okay, great. Your motor racing life started at the age of 13 as a flag marshal in Australia. Please tell us, what was the spark for your interest in racing and about those early days?
Well, I grew up in Australia, as you rightly say. My dad was, bless him, wonderful father. I couldn't have had a better dad. And he, although we lived in Australia, we played several trips back to England every 4 years, in fact, as a family. And I remember in 1962, when I was 10, my family, I have to say, were absolutely mad, still are, on horse racing, by which I mean steeplechasing in England, jumps on grass, a very specific type of horse racing. And we were going to some of that in England on Easter Monday. And I remember we were in my cousin's little Morris Minor, and he had a little transistor radio in a leather case and an aerial on the roof. Nothing was very, we couldn't hear, it was crackly. And it was the day Stirling Moss had his accident at Goodwood. And I remember in between the horse racing commentary, they kept jumping, I think, to Robin Richards on the radio saying there's just been a big accident at Goodwood. The great British driver Stirling Moss has been seriously injured. We'll give you more information when we have it. Meanwhile, Graham Hill is the leader of the race. And I remember at the time thinking, wow, that's really interesting. What a terrible thing this poor man's had this accident. But what a feeling of excitement there was there. And I obviously did some research at that point and persuaded one of my godmothers to buy me a Scalextric set, and I started looking at all the diagrams and which car I could be on and choose. And then not long after that, Jim Clark published his autobiography, 64 indeed, and that really captured me. I read that from front cover to cover. It's the first book I ever read, ever bought, and I can still memorize most of the prose in that book. And Jim Clark became my new focus in life, really, at the age of, 12?
Very interesting you mentioned Robin Richards. My interest in motor racing, what really made the difference in 1973, BBC had a program called, I think, Sports Call on Saturdays, BBC World Service, and I'll never forget at 7 o'clock when it would start, the guy said, we'll go to Le Mans for the start of the race with Robin Richards, and I still remember him saying, Matra, Ferrari, Matra. Very interesting. Okay, Tasman was a great series. Did you ever meet Timmy Mayer, brother of Teddy Mayer?
Sadly not. 1964, the year he raced at Warwick Farm, my circuit, and I only went to this Warwick Farm until I was a bit old enough to travel. Tim was Bruce's teammate, obviously. That was the first appearance of Bruce McLaren Motor Racing Limited. I saw him drive, that's all I can say, and I saw him from about as far away as I am from you now. But I was too young to be able to say, hello, I'm Peter Windsor, pleased to meet you. But I was in awe of Tim. I knew what he'd done in America. I knew what he'd done in Formula Junior, even in Mini Coopers in England for a little bit. And Tyler Alexander came over with him. I remember seeing Tyler there. And obviously, I was a big Bruce McLaren fan, as well as I've just said I was a Clark fan. But if I had to nominate my second driver, it would have been Bruce McLaren. And I loved the way his helmet was, the way he smiled, the way he looked in the car. I loved the Coopers at that point. And it all captured my imagination. And I was absolutely heartbroken when I heard the news. I can still remember the exact phraseology they used. It was a Saturday afternoon. I was in my house in Australia, and there was no television of the Tasman races at all away from Sydney. And I knew they were in Longford, Tasmania, and I remember getting the news report of... it was after. They'd said who was qualified first, etc. And they said, and practice was marred by an accident involving the young American driver, Tim Mayer, whose car became airborne on the approach to the Longford pub, hit the trees, and Tim later succumbed to his injuries, is the phrase they used. And I remember asking my dad, what does that mean, succumbed to his injuries? And then I was completely heartbroken. And I think that was probably one of the first times I'd kind of come face to face with the mortality of drivers and what motor racing really meant to many of them.
That's what Sever's accident did that to me in 73. Okay, my favorite story from your days in Australia is talking about Jim Clark mowing the lawn of the Gagan family. Let's hear what led to this, please.
Well, that was a story that I heard through Leo Gagan, who was a wonderful, still is a wonderful guy. He was a great driver, very consistent. And the Gagan family were an institution in Australian motorsport from the very early 60s, and they were the Lotus dealers for New South Wales, so they had all the latest Lotus stuff, and their basic colours were black, and they were just immaculate. And Jim was very close to Leo and his brother Ian, who raced, and Tom, the father, who was running the whole show for a while before he passed away. And the Lotus in 66, the Lotus 39 Tasman car was, and 65, was garaged at the Gagans up the road from Warwick Farm at Liverpool. All very convenient. The circuit and the Gagan headquarters are very near one another. And one day Jim turned up at the house to meet Leo, and they were going to have a barbecue or whatever, and Leo was late, not there, and his mum was there, and she was expecting a gardener to mow the lawns. And when Jim turned up, she said, and this is Leo telling me this, she said, oh, I'm glad you're here, you're a bit late, anyway, the mower's over there. So Jimmy, A, think he was quite funny, and B, probably because he quite enjoyed mowing lawns, I know quite a lot of people that do, got on with it and started mowing the lawn, and Leo arrived to find Jimmy Clark mowing his lawn.
Fantastic story. Yeah. It was around this time you met Peter Collins, and later you hooked up with him in England. What was your first job, and what was the goal when you came back to the UK?
Well, I met Peter because in my school holidays, I got a job with the local club that ran the motor racing at Warwick Farm, and that was not ordinary motor racing, nor was it an ordinary circuit. We're talking one of the best racing circuits in the world, Warwick Farm. It no longer exists, and the AARC, Australian Automobile Racing Club, one of the best run organizational clubs ever in the history of motorsport, I would say without any doubt at all. Jeff Sykes was the man behind it. He started life at the BARC and was sent out to Australia to design Warwick Farm and then create the organizational structure. So I worked for Jeff and his very small team of people in my school holidays, stamping letters, sealing envelopes, cleaning cars, getting the lunch for them, just to be a part of the motor racing world. I didn't get paid, obviously, but I got a lunch every day, and I got up every morning at, you know, 6 o'clock. I was always there at the office. I loved it, cleaning the windows, just to be a part of the motor racing world. And I met Peter Collins there because and that was another reason to be there, because the AARC offices had a subscription to Motoring News and Autosport, and it was my first chance to read motor racing news as it happened within sort of 2 or 3 weeks of it happening. So that was a wonderful thing, and Peter used to come in and read the magazines as well, and we started chatting, so we got to know one another very well. And he was a couple of years older than I, and he was karting quite early on, so I started getting into that with Peter. And but later on, I went to England and started writing as a journalist. And in answer to your question, there was a moment when Andrew Ferguson said to me, I can remember it was at Thruxton, that Lotus were looking for an assistant team manager, because he, Andrew, was no longer going to fly. He just had a complete phobia about flying, and they needed a guy who was capable of being Andrew's assistant but going to races. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, I'd love to do that myself, and then thinking, oh no, I wouldn't be good enough to do that, but Peter would be great for that. And so Peter was just getting married in Sydney, and I sent him a telegram, not an email, telegram in the days of telegrams, and I said, congratulations to you, I hope everything's gone well. By the way, I think I can get you an interview at Lotus for a job as assistant team manager, but you need to get over here within a week. And he did, and he came over, and I'm sure Jane, his wife, didn't appreciate it, but Peter then stayed with me for 3 or 4 months while all those negotiations went on. He got a part-time job at Ralt, and then he got in as the assistant team manager. And because I had Peter in there, when I met Nigel Mansell for the first time and started to really believe in Nigel, I used my connection with Peter to get Nigel a test with Peter's help in the F1 car, and then get him the contract with Lotus, and then everything went from there. So one thing led to another, and if I hadn't got Peter in at Lotus, I doubt I would have been able to help Nigel get in at Lotus, and Nigel probably would never have gone into Formula One.
Now, Nigel is in the next question. How important was the support of Pace Petroleum in getting Arnage to the big league? And I guess you were the main man behind the sponsorship?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I met Nigel, I was riding for Autocar, and actually I met him through a wonderful guy who was Trevor Taylor's manager, and he and I became friends because I wanted to meet Trevor, who was Jim Clark's teammate, and find out lots of Jim Clark stories from Trevor. And indeed, I was a huge Trevor Taylor fan as well. So he rang me one day and said, I've just met an English driver who's as good as anybody I've seen since Jimmy. You've got to see him drive. And so I did. I went over, and Nigel was in Formula Ford at that point. And yeah, he was really good. But then I went up to Birmingham to meet him, where he mortgaged his house. He was just on the point of mortgaging his house to finance 5 races in a March Formula 3 car. And I went to see him first time out in the March, out the back at Thruxton. And I remember at that moment, I'd already been on the road quite a long time with Carlos Reutemann, so I started to get a pretty good feel. Something I think I'd always had anyway, for being able to watch the way drivers do work in cars and how they use their hands and their feet. And Nigel, to my eye, was absolutely right there. He was another Carlos Reutemann, the way he drove. Very fingertippy, very good at getting the car early into the corner, never loaded up the front too much, very good at coming out of the brake pedal press at the right rate to get the front to work, and just very, very economical in the way he was driving. And I became a believer in Nigel. And on top of that, you know, the fact that he had lots of other things. He was a crack clay pigeon shot like Jackie Stewart. He was a single-figure handicap golfer. He was very good at judo at that point and karate, and lots of things going for him. And so I just started writing letters, and I used to get to my office 2 hours earlier than I needed to, and I'd spend those 2 hours from 6 until 8 at Autocar composing and writing letters to potential sponsors for Nigel. I bought the Times 1000 book of companies and just went through them one by one, wrote to them all, usually to the CEO. I was reading lots of books on how to raise sponsorship at that point, and I used to then follow up, and I remember ringing Victor Gauntlet one day of Pace, and I just rang him and I said, because I'd read somewhere that you should ring very early in the morning, you might get the CEO at his desk early in the morning before the secretary comes in, and there was some article I'd read in the New York Times, I think, and Victor Gauntlet picked up the phone, and I said, I'm Peter Windsor, I wrote to you. He said, oh yes, I remember, you're the chap that wants me to make a bet on a young driver, a bit like betting on a horse. I said, well, it's not really that, it's just that if he doesn't make Formula One, you won't get your money back. But if he does, and there's a conflict of sponsors between your company and the F1 team, you will get your money back. And he said, oh, this sounds interesting. Come and have lunch. So I had lunch. And, yeah, we did. We found the money that was to keep him racing in Formula 3 in 1980, whereas his first five races were in 78. So, yeah, I think it helped a lot. He was doing Formula 3 while he was... I'd also helped him get the Ralph F2 Honda test drive with Ron Toranak. He did a couple of races. And at that point, Peter and I got him in at Lotus as a test driver there as well, or test contract, and he did a bit of testing as well. So, yeah, it was a good thing.
One guy who did not believe in Nigel Mansell was Peter Waugh, that he would give Nigel the good and bad news at the Brazilian Grand Prix. Good news, I have 2 passes. Bad news, none for you. And you were there. What was wrong there? These people could not work together.
Well, I think there were 2 things with Nigel. One was, if you didn't actually watch him drive and you just based your assessment, as most people do in motor racing, I think, on how the guy is in the paddock area, what his handshake's like, what he talks about, and indeed his results, it was very easy, if you wanted to, in all that period, to paint a pretty black picture of Nigel Mansell. He was not an easy guy, never has been, never will be. He's the sort of guy born to be the commander of a ship, and if you want to be on his ship and play by his rules and take his orders, fine, but if you don't even bother. And of course, he'd never been in quick cars. I mean, if we assume now Nigel is a great Grand Prix driver in the history of the sport, of all the drivers who take that title, a great Grand Prix driver, he is the one driver that stands out as never having competitive cars until about 1980, back end of 85. So he spent a lot of his career in underfinanced, poor machinery, and so he never really looked very good. But if you look between the lines, he was always good. Monaco 1980, Formula 3 race, the March 803 was diabolical. If you couldn't drive in that race unless you're in a March 793, which was a much better car, and as soon as you touched the curb, the top rocker arm bent in half. That's how bad the March 803 was. Nigel was the only 803 driver to qualify for the final. Nobody noticed it, and he finished second last, I think. But that was an epic drive. That was Nigel's drive that we saw at Monaco in 92 or 87 when he should have won was the drive he did in 1980, but nobody saw it. And I think Peter Waugh, sadly, was only looking at the results and the handshake, and I don't remember Peter ever being out on the circuit watching Nigel. And I think the other thing is that there was basically a groundswell of opinion in the press at the time, the Autosport particularly, not necessarily Motor News, but more Autosport, they were not very pro-Nigel either. He wasn't an easy guy to interview. He wasn't an easy guy to talk to. Derek Warwick, Kenny Acheson, Stefan Johansson, they were the cool guys. Nigel was always an effort. And I do remember, and I think you're probably going to see it there, that 1980 Austrian Grand Prix, when we'd got Nigel a chance in the third works Lotus, that Autosport actually said, we can't believe Lotus have signed Mansell. There are many more British drivers deserving of this opportunity. And that was Autosport 1980, which is the same Autosport that then had something like 6 front covers in a row with Nigel Mansell on it in 1992. You know, need I say more?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, you try to do a deal. How are we doing on time?
10 minutes.
Okay, you try to do a deal with Shark, Greg Norman, to buy the Brabham team in 1989. Can you please tell us how you convinced him on this deal and what were the main reasons for this deal ending up in a court of law?
Well, Greg was never part of the purchase of the team, and it was I was in business with Walter Brunn, who had won the World Sports Car Championship the year before, Swiss Porsche entrant, part-time driver. He had a fledgling F1 team called Eurobrun at that point, Eurobrun, and he wanted to do a lot more than that. And I was at Williams at the time, and he he and I got together. He approached me and said, you know, I'd love you to come in and run this operation. It's going to be my team, but you can have a small percentage of it. But I'd like you to run it and put it together. And I was quite enthusiastic about that. He said, you know, we're going to run Stefano Modena in one car. He's my driver, but we got enough. I will underwrite the budget for 2 years, and we got enough to sign another driver up to X amount. We need to decide what engines we're going to use, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the things I'd always thought, and still think today actually, is that there's quite a lot of synergy between golf and motorsport, partly because of the timing and the hand-eye coordination you need for golf and the patience, and I think a lot of that applies to driving a racing car. But I think there's also another little thing about golf, which is that on the pro-am days, the pro golfers tend to play rounds with CEO Fortune 500 people, and if you were into Formula One and you got a stake in a Formula One team, it's a great time to be talking to new potential sponsors for a Formula One team. Much better opportunity than racing people ever get. And I'd put Nigel and Greg together because I was very keen on golf, still am, and Nigel was, and I had an opportunity to before the South Australian Open 1 year when we were at the Australian Grand Prix at Williams. I got Nigel an entry in the pro-am there, and I knew Greg was playing, so I asked the organizer to put Nigel with Greg, so I put them together and knew that it would be a marriage made in heaven, and it was. And through that, obviously, I met Greg, and I told Greg what we were doing, and I said, Greg, you know, it is the Brabham team that Brun is going to buy, and it's an Australian team. If you'd love to be associated with any way, we would love to do it. You know, and what I'm thinking is exactly what I just said. You know, you're going to be playing with some serious people, and you know, if you've got an interest in an F1 team, not a financial interest, but just an interest, it'd be a great thing for you to play around with and have some fun with. And he said, yeah, what a great idea, I'd love to do that. But it didn't get very far because Brun disappeared from the scene. It wasn't his money that he was spending, it was somebody else's, who was then arrested for embezzlement, and I was caught in the middle because by then obviously I'd given up my job at Williams, and I had all these people saying I had no stake in the team, which this new guy who subsequently got arrested was supposedly owning and running. So I got thrown to the wolves and left with nothing. So I had to take everybody to court, and I never got to trial, but I got 7 injunctions, all of which went my way. And eventually, of course, I engineered a settlement, and that all got sorted. But it was a pretty tough 2 years. But I learned a lot about Formula One people and legal matters, shall we say.
Now, you were also involved in the USF on a program. Can you tell us what went wrong there, or anything you want to say on this?
Well, I'd love to, because it's a similar story to the Brabham thing. If I can look myself in the mirror and feel that I gave it 100% and my intentions were right, and I think it would have been very good. I really think we had a great plan there, but so many things happened that I'd never predicted. I suppose you could argue, I should have predicted them, but they fell outside the normal things you predict and worry about, which are in no particular order: are we going to have enough money, will we have the right drivers, will the car be any good, all the things you normally worry about. All the things that happened were nothing to do with that, but the FIA have said, we don't want you to talk about that. There's a lot of stuff there that would not be good if it came out. So I still abide by what the FIA have instructed.
I appreciate your feedback. Okay, now we come to your all-time favorite front cover, the July 1968 issue of Motor Racing and Sports Car magazine. Excellent snapshot by you. Please explain the man and his ladies and the occasion.
Well, I actually bought a copy of that full magazine off eBay the other day because I had the front cover, but I hadn't got the magazine, but I got the whole thing now. But yeah, I was a big Piers Courage fan. I was a fan of many drivers, but Piers came out to the Tasman Series in 68. I was very impressed. I knew about him then. I knew he was a quick F2, F3 driver, but to see him drive that little McLaren M4A and finish third at Warwick Farm behind Jimmy and Graham, just superb. And then, of course, he won at Longford. And so I became a big Piers Courage fan. And then this magazine, Motor Racing, was a wonderful magazine in the 60s. It was a fairly straightforward front cover for a long time, just a yellow strip with Motor Racing on it and a nice picture. And I've actually got one from 65 when Jimmy's on the front cover in the IndyCar and I got that signed by Jimmy at Warwick Farm, that front cover, so I've still got that. But their motor racing went upbeat, and they had these really jazzy front covers, and I couldn't believe that they were as creative and artistic as they were. And when they got this shot of Piers with his wife on one side and some dolly bird on the other, and then the little caption line, "It takes courage to do this," I thought that was just a great front cover. Everything about it I loved. The fact that it was Piers, it was just one cover line. It wasn't plastered with lots of, you know, inside this. It was just that one picture that said it all. And they got Piers to pose for that picture, and Sally, his wife, was in there too. I just thought, what a wonderful thing.
Exactly. Okay, now, like I said, I've enjoyed your work for many, many years. So here is my favorite question to you. If Peter Windsor was turning 22 or 21 in 2014 and making his F1 debut in Albert Park for Ferrari, what will be his choice, Hitco, Brembo, or Carbon Industries?
Very good question. I think it would be Hitco, actually, only because I think to run Carbon Industries, you've got to have the brake pedal sensitivity of Lewis Hamilton. And I think to run the Brembos, you've got to be thinking, I want to jam these brakes on as hard as I can and not have any problem. In other words, you've got to have a lot of margin. I think the Hitco is a nice compromise between the two. But more than that, I love their Art Deco 60s, 50s, 40s, 30s building in LA. I love that whole part of American aerospace near LAX that grew up after the Second World War, all those companies, Metalor, and Hitco's one of those, really, in terms of where it blossomed. And it's just a great feel to it. And I also like the kind of cool aspect that it's an American company. Not many people in Formula One know about them or care about them. And there they are, providing brakes to Kimi Raikkonen and Romain Grosjean, doing a good job. So, yeah, I think it would be Hitco. Thanks for asking the question.
Great. Finally, how about a message to our listeners? We have listeners all over the world, Australia, UK, everywhere. I'm sure they would love to hear from you.
Well, it's very sweet of you to say that. I'm sure there are many more people they would love to hear from before me. But all I can say is that I love the past, I love the present, I love the future, and I don't think anybody should be pigeonholed. And I think this webcast does a very good job of embracing all parts of every part of motor racing, as indeed I try to do on my blog and on my show. And I just hope that we never forget the heroes of the past, because without them, we wouldn't be where we are today. Equally, I don't think we should ever take our eye off the ball and look at the next heroes who are coming along in the future. And we're talking here somewhere near the GP3 paddock, in the away from the Formula One circuit, but we've been watching GP3 from afar. And to me, watching those young guys is part of still the excitement of what I love about motor racing. But most of all, thank you for putting this together and for being as enthusiastic and as passionate as you are. It's wonderful to meet people like you.
Thank you so much.
Peter, thanks for joining F1Weekly.com. Good night.